Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome once again to another episode of the tech podcast, Rulor Magazine. I am your host, Dan Cavallari, and I am here in Colorado today. And it's starting, you can start to feel a little bit of fall in the air, even though it's only August. It actually snowed up in the mountains today. So it's that time of year where a lot of people are sort of transitioning from road to gravel and sort of thinking about the upcoming season and where they want to be on their bikes. And luckily for us, there are so many incredible options for both on the pavement, off the pavement, mixing the two. We're living in this incredible era of bicycle design. And it got me to thinking, you know, I've been sick this week, so I've been doing a lot of thinking and not a whole lot of riding, which is why I sound a little congested. But it got me to thinking about how brands start to develop ideas. You know, you have an idea, and how does that idea get from idea to finished product? I mean, there's a lot of steps in between. I've been to a lot of different facilities, and I think every brand has their own way of doing it. But there's some brands that really just have some unique resources at their disposal, and not to mention a unique history. And so today on the line, all the way from Switzerland, I have Stefan Christ. And Stefan is a longtime member of the BMC development team. Stefan, how's it going?
Hello, Dan. Very good. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, of course, and thanks for chatting. And Stefan, what's your official title over there at BMC now? You've been there a long time.
Today I'm working as head of R&D, overlooking basically, let's say, the development of all products that carry a BMC logo.
No pressure at all. Very low pressure role.
Yeah, it's quite a wide field now with all the e-bikes and components, but it's good. Always new challenges. It's great.
And the last time I was over there in Switzerland, Stifu's your nickname. Stifu's job was essentially to rip my legs off up every climb in Switzerland. Stifu's a monster on the bike, as I learned the hard way. I was there. What was that? Boy, that was 2 years ago now, I think, maybe more, for the launch of the BMC Earth, BMC's gravel bike. And you know, Stifu, that was an eye-opening launch because at that time, gravel was just starting to come into its own as a category. The bikes were really getting honed, and you guys launched the Urs, which is a beautiful bike. I assume since then, BMC has been developing and plotting what's next. Can you talk a little bit about what you see as the next steps in gravel bike development?
Sure. I remember this ride very well. I think it was really
me too.
One of the best launches we ever did. Also because it was the first time we launched actually a gravel bike. So the Earth was our very first development in this segment, and we really wanted to, I would say, do something that is a bit out of the convention back in the day. We were always talking about Gravel Plus because we had the idea of making a very capable gravel bike, which showed in the geometry concept and a couple of other things. We introduced the micro travel technology on the rear end of the Urs bike. And this is definitely something that we we fall in love with as a concept. And we have been working very hard over the last years to find solution for this, also to have this on the front end, because of course comfort, the more you ride off-road, is important. So my team have worked very hard to work on additional MTT solutions, which we will see in a couple of months from now in the market.
So keep your eyes open is what you're saying. And for those of you listening, if you're not familiar with the MTT, it came over from the mountain bike side, correct? The elastomer-based connection on the stays, the seat stays, correct?
Yeah, we introduced this on the Team Elite, which was our cross-country hardtail. And there the intention was to reduce riders' fatigue as a primary goal. And we have discovered that it's also gonna give good benefits, performance benefits on gravel bikes, and that's why we stick to the concept.
One of the things I learned pretty quickly when I visited the facility in Switzerland is that BMC is pretty uniquely set up to develop, take bikes from concept to development. The facility itself has a lot of aspects that perhaps a lot of other brands don't have. I think our tour there started in the museum, where you have all these bikes from past pros, and you know, you walked us through some of the technology there and what worked, what didn't, what we changed over time. And that was an interesting place to start, because BMC has a very long history of innovation, and that museum really drives that point home. So can you walk me through a little bit about how you bring a bike from concept to finished product, and specifically how the BMC facility contributes to that process? Because like I said, the museum is just the first touch point and in the facility, and it gives you that history. But from there, you enter this incredible facility with the Impact Lab and all the things that you can do to take those historical elements and understand how they played a part in the development of past bikes and take them through a new development to a new bike. Talk to me about that process and how BMC approaches it in sort of a unique way.
Yeah, I mean, ideas for new bikes, they can come up from many different areas. It can be commercial opportunities. It can be single people who have an idea which through their riding passion, they believe this is something that would benefit my ride. And probably I think this is where we are unique in the facilities we have, because we have a prototype lab where really, if someone has an idea, we have shown and we are very convinced that we can turn this idea into a prototype that can actually validate the feasibility or the idea within a super short time. And we have a number of very talented people that they always find the right way to make the prototype, I would say, just as good as it has to be to validate a certain idea. And so usually within 2 to 4 weeks after the idea, we are on the track or on the road to validate this concept. And it was actually, I would say, not really a strategic move at the beginning, this Impact Lab. It was kind of created out of the leftovers from the production we had in Switzerland. So we had all the equipment, we had the expertise and the people. And when we shut down the production facility because it was just not covering the cost, we thought, what do we do with it? What do we do with all this know-how and the CNC machine and the lamination room and all this? So the Impact Lab was born.
And that was born from the Impact bike, correct?
Impact frame production, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah. Which was produced in your headquarters in Grinchen. And so all that equipment basically was left over and allowed you to create prototypes as necessary. Is that correct? Yeah.
And from there on, then really we realized that it's a strategic tool, because things like micro travel technology, the MTT, is something that I think without building prototypes ourselves, with all the layup for the chain stays and everything, we would not have been able to find an outside supplier who is convinced of the idea. And it's always much easier once you have something in your hands to go to a supplier and ask them, can we talk about this? Is this something you can do? And of course, you don't want to do a prototype. You want to produce multiple bikes.
Right. So. Now, you also have a pretty unique setup in Grinchen. Right across the street from the headquarters is a velodrome. How does that factor into, do you use that facility to test prototypes, or is it more of a head out into the hills of Switzerland situation?
I think it's a dual opportunity. Of course, on one side, it is when it really comes to racing products, and then I'm talking about a road racing product. It is for sure a testing facility that we use, whether it's for our own developments or together with the teams that come here or individual riders. It's a great track. It's 250 meters, which really allows for very good testing, reliable testing. So this is just a pillar in our performance testing. But moreover, I think it has become one more discipline for all of us who are passionate riders. And as you could imagine, sometimes winter in Switzerland is not only dark, but it's also cold and it's not so bicycle friendly. And especially on those days, it's just great to spin your legs, even if it's just 45 minutes over lunch. And sometimes ideas are born on the track.
Yeah. Just a bit of sanity in the dark winter. I'm curious, when you prototype a bike or a frame and you're able to create that prototype, I assume it doesn't just go straight from idea to prototyping. I mean, there's got to be some CFD involved. And is that correct? I mean, CFD, for those of you listening, is computational fluid dynamics. And it basically is putting the parameters of that frame into a computer to understand how it will react to certain forces and certain airflow, things like that. So what are the steps between idea and prototype?
So when it comes to I would say laminate design and really final frame design and shapes, we are heavily using computer tools, whether this is CFD or FEM, which of course then we just benefit from this as kind of a virtual prototyping. We can run many loops that of course are faster than if for every iteration you would build a physical prototype. So I would say in the space of aerodynamics, in the space of structural strength and stiffness, it's those tools that have taken over from the physical prototyping. Nevertheless, once those steps are done and the virtual design of a new product is done, we do a prototype and we test it. But I would say the Impact Lab often plays a role when it's about functional prototyping. But all this together, I think what we have developed over the time is a good expertise as well to understand which kind of prototyping and calculation do we need to get to the validation step as quickly as possible. And
I want to talk about the Impact Lab in just a moment, but I have one quick question before we jump into that, which is a lot of manufacturers in recent years have relied heavily upon 3D printing because it has in just in recent years has gotten a little bit, it's gotten a lot more feasible to use. It's quicker. You can build a lot of prototypes fairly quickly. Does that factor into your prototyping processes? Do you use 3D printing at all?
Massively, yeah, massively. And actually, it took quite some time until I was convinced myself to buy a 3D printing machine, because we had, honestly, we had very easy access to outside 3D printing companies. And so we are 3D printing for many, many years, just not internal. But now, since a bit more than a year, we have a printer inside. Now it's even two. And honestly, I didn't expect it, but basically they are running day and night. And it's really great for the prototyping, but also during the commercial realization phase of a design. You know, today on e-bikes, for instance, there's many covers and plastic parts, and for this it's just great to have those things on the bike before you go in the investment of a expensive injection molding tool and things like that. So it's really great.
And so from there, there's steps in between, but then, you know, the Impact Lab handles a lot of that testing beyond the fluid dynamics aspects that we talked about. Now, for those of you who are having trouble picturing the Impact Lab, one of the rooms that has always stuck out in my mind, having visited the facility, was there's this room where there's these frames are mounted in jigs, and they're moving constantly over and over again. So they're testing the frame to see how much movement it can take, how many flexes until failure, things like that. It's a really fascinating place to see. Once you get into the Impact Lab, Steve, can you talk a little bit about the process, how you take a brand new prototype and say, okay, we're going to give this the Impact Lab treatment? What's the process like there?
Yeah, you're talking about the test lab side of the Impact Lab, which plays a tremendous role. So every prototype that we write, before we write it, we are qualifying and quantifying actually all the parameters that we can, whether it's weight, whether it's stiffness, whether it's precision and geometry details. This is all taken. So when we write it, we can actually do the association between what we measure and what we feel. And this is, I think, where a big part of the experience that we all have on BMC side comes together. Because when you design a new product, at one point you have to put down numbers that you want to achieve. And the numbers is usually not the first thing we have in mind. What we have in mind is a certain riding behavior or a certain feel. And with all the experience we have, it's then quite easy to correlate this feeling with number and measurable targets. So there the test lab plays a huge role. And we are testing frames really in, let's say, every physical development stage that we go, from the very first product to the pilot run, from the final production. We always take frames to see how consistent the performance values are. So It's very fundamental.
You know, once things get out of the Impact Lab and have sort of been validated and go to manufacturing, it's interesting to me as a consumer to have to measure the differences between a BMC and another brand, or even just a BMC against another BMC. So, for example, I currently have in my garage here a Road Machine 012, which is a beautiful bike. And you also have this Masterpiece MPC, which BMC very quietly released about a year ago, maybe a little bit more. And this Masterpiece MPC is very intriguing to me. It seems like sort of an engineer's dream. And I'm curious, It's basically, you know, you guys call it the masterpiece. So it's supposed to be this halo product that is perfect, essentially. If I'm going to go from this Road Machine 012, which, by the way, is a phenomenally wonderful ride, to this masterpiece, are there things I'm going to notice, or is this more of a, you know, you noticed differences in the lab and that's what makes it so, quote unquote, perfect? I mean, explain to me, once that came out of the impact lab, how you knew that's the masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, as you call it out, masterpiece is really engineering dream, and it's something that we have strived for many years. And it has two sides. One clearly is the performance, and I think this is what you will notice, of course, when you go on the bike. In this case, the performance aspect that you will notice compared to the bike you were mentioning, the Road Machine, is primarily the weight, because we were shooting actually for same stiffness and compliance behavior as our standard Road Machine. So all Road Machine, actually, they have a very similar riding behavior from a, let's say, stiffness and compliance point of view. Of course, then the weight difference, you will feel. We all know this, light road bikes, you feel differences quite easily. But what really makes a masterpiece very unique is that it is a frame that you take out of the mold and it is done. So every fiber that you see in the end was exactly laid down on the surface of this frame like that and was untouched. So we do not use any finishing. There's no sanding, there's no clear coat, there's nothing like that. And that also means that we have to produce this frame as a one-piece construction. Typically, frames are made out of a front triangle, and then you add the rear frame to it, you bond this together, sand it, and then there's the painting step. And masterpiece is really produced in one shot. So it's a one-piece frame. There's no connections. And the fact that we can produce this quality that doesn't need any, let's say, finishing steps, also means that all the fibers, every layer of this frame is exactly in the position that that we want to have it to be. And yeah, I would say it's as much engineering stream in terms of how it rides, but also how it's produced. And I think once you have the opportunity to see such a frame in life, you immediately see that this is something very, very special, because it's clearly distinguished from what we all know out in the market.
Yeah. Now, I guess, is the MPC, because it is so meticulously constructed, is it constructed by hand, or is it a machine constructed frame?
No, it's actually, yeah, it's constructed by a master.
Okay.
So I would say there is very few people who actually can do such a frame. And we are producing in a small facility. We can only produce few frames per week. It's very, very limited, due to the fact that it's really one person making the entire frame, which is quite unique. Usually there is many, many people or many, many hands frame goes through. In this case, it's really typically it's one person who is producing one frame.
Are those made in Grenchen?
No, we make them actually in Germany.
Germany, okay. And now BMC, I remember you have... you were weaving your own carbon for a while. You had a big loom, correct? And you could weave your own carbon fibers. Are you still doing that? And does that factor into the build of the MPC?
No, we have given up on the big weaving machine. Multiple reasons. It was we require a big output to have it economically efficient. And Then as a second point, it's clear that with today's weight targets of, let's say, 700 to 800 grams for a frame, woven tubes cannot compete with the laydown prepreg frames. So it's performance, but also cost that let us move away from this technology. On the other hand, the braiding process is a great process if you want to automate your production. But for this, we don't have the quantities to do this.
Now, just one last question for you, Sifu, is, every year we see a limited number of frames get released by manufacturers. How many ideas actually do you take from concept to prototype? I mean, is it, 10 ideas per year, 100 ideas per year, and then you prototype them and see how they work to get to that one bike that gets launched per year? What I'm asking is, how involved is this process of prototyping? Are you constantly prototyping, or is it just set to a limited number of ideas per year?
The limits are given by our capacity and by the number of people we have. But I can tell you, many of my team members, they are doing night shifts to realize their ideas and to prototype them. Typically, I would say there's a certain room and time allocated to do prototypes. But I think all of us, once we have an idea, and as you know, ideas are not coming in a regular pace. Sometimes you have three together, and then for 3 months you're kind of starving. So I would say, as an overall quota, we could say that probably every fourth to fifth idea that we have is one that we go further to then think about the commercial product. So yeah, in all honesty, we have many ideas that do not make it to commercial products. That could be for functional reason, that something doesn't work. Also, in many cases, it's pure cost driven. But yeah, there are also ideas that we take up 2 years later. We remember, hey, back in the day, we did this, and we can recombine things. And I think this is then where it's really great. And combining technologies, I think this is also a benefit of developing and doing the innovation in-house. This is then very easy. And I think in the near future, we will see some products that are combinations of things that we have already done.
Very cool. That's a neat way to take the best elements of the last several years of development and combine them into something that's, brand new. That's pretty fascinating. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we get back, I will be speaking with Ruler Magazine's very own Peter Stewart to get some perspective of what he and I have seen on our many, many tours of various manufacturing facilities. Steve, thanks for joining me today. And for the rest of you, please sit tight. We'll be right back.
So my name is Oren Peleg, and I'm an investor in Leka. Three things that really caught my eye. The first one is they're looking to change the insurance industry, which is a very large industry and I think needs change. The second thing is I'm deeply passionate about getting people on two wheel. We need to address our congestion and pollution crisis, and I believe that two wheels have a massive role to play in that. And the third thing is I can see a growing trend around companies building on the strong communities that they have. And I think Lacquer's business model in the way they tap into the community of cyclists is something that's very much on trend at the moment.
Hold up. Why, hello there. Podcast interruption alert, but I will only take a few short moments to say that if you're enjoying this podcast, you will love the regular magazine. So if you're not a reader already, then you can subscribe at ruler.cc for as little as £6 per month. If you don't speak Northern Irish, that's 6 times 100 pennies. And for the price of a few coffees, you get regular columns from the wonderful Ned Bolting, myself, Orla Shinowy, and some of the very finest independent cycling journalism there is, all wrapped up in a wondrously beautiful publication. Go to ruler.cc. I'll leave you to it.
We are back with the Ruler Tech podcast, and we just spent a lot of time hearing about BMC's facilities in Gränschen, Switzerland, and how that sort of leads to a better product for BMC's consumers. And that's from their perspective, and it is all very interesting. It's all very cool, and it seems to work for them. Now, there's other brands out there, and they're doing things differently. I have been fortunate over the course of my career to visit a lot of those facilities, as has Peter Stewart, who is on the line now, all the way from London. Peter, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks, Dan. How are you?
I'm well. Well, a little sniffly, but I'm okay. But Peter, you and I have both been to, I would say, a fair bit of manufacturing facilities for bicycles. And, you know, one of the things that I've gleaned from going to all these places is that every company does things a little different in terms of development, testing, and things like that. In your experience going to some of these facilities, because you've been to quite a few as well, what stands out to you in terms of what everybody is doing similarly across the board in manufacturing, and what are people doing differently when it comes to R&D, testing, and things like that?
Yeah, certainly. I've been to literally dozens of factories and assembly facilities, and sometimes feels like school trips, going out there with other journalists and being hoarded around like different kind of, you know, spindles for making wheels and hot presses for making frames. And yeah, it's actually pretty interesting how similar lots of them are. And it's, I always enjoy seeing when someone does something slightly differently. And, you know, the normal expectation most people have is that you know, these things are made with carbon fiber, you know, like glued, you know, obviously then put together in segments and then in a monocoque kind of press. And a lot of people think that then goes into an autoclave, but the autoclave process is relatively rare. Usually it's a hot metal press that offers the pressure that makes the frame, which is actually a pretty good way to do it. And that's why it's the most common way of doing it. And that's why in the Far East, where the vast majority of the world's bicycles are made, that's what they do every single time. But definitely Impec was a great example of where you see something really different, which was the big resin transfer molding process that Look also use. And, you know, as kind of discussed in the kind of by BMC, that was a really interesting process that offered them a lot of insight into the R&D, and effectively looked like a big stargate, and they kind of weave through these carbon threads into a sock that then had resin pumped through it. And yeah, it's very elaborate, and I think it was interesting. I think I used to think that that was a better way of doing it than other ways, but I don't think there's a better way or a worse way. It's just different kind of processes to reach the same end. So yeah, seeing that manufacturing process from different facilities and different brands does really offer you a lot more kind of appreciation of the sport and the sports products we have, because it is an expensive and very like engineering heavy process. And then equally, you know, a lot of people like Canyon do something very different, where their real expertise comes from logistics, and they're just getting the frames in to Germany, and that's a facility that's really impressive, but really it's an assembly facility, but done so much better than anything I've seen from any other brand. And yeah, I'm always fascinated to see the inside workings of different brands like that, from all elements, whether it's paint or actual manufacturing or R&D or, you know, carbon kind of rapid prototyping. So yeah, it's an interesting process. And I think the definitely it's come on light years from where we were, you know, 15, 20 years ago. I think it is a really high tech trade now.
Yeah. And I think you hit on something really important there, which is that a lot of manufacturing across the board for all these manufacturers is really streamlining processes so that they can do this faster, with less cost, things like that. And so, you know, Trek is another great example of that. In Waterloo, Wisconsin, they've got all their facilities are honed to a point where everything's very efficient. They've got assembly lines, they've got wheel builders all in the same big room, you know, to get everything out the door quickly. Custom paint is just down the hall. But to that end, I've also been to some facilities where it's one guy in a garage, you know, doing every aspect of it. And that's, that can lead to a product that's just as good. But I think in terms of scale, you've got a vast difference between those small builders and what Trek or BMC or Canyon is doing. But beyond that, what I find intriguing, you know, I've been to BMC's headquarters in Gretchen, as I think you have as well. And I've been to Trek. And what I find notable about both of those places is that, you know, in Gretchen, as we mentioned in the podcast earlier today, they have a velodrome across the street, you know, for real world testing. They can just walk across the street and pedal prototypes or walk outside. And Trek in the same fashion has, you know, a cyclocross course right out their front door in on the grounds of Trek's headquarters. How do you feel about those sort of practical approaches to testing? I mean, do you think that lends anything different to, say, prototyping something and then, you know, getting a product out with just, you know, whatever wheels are lying around and then going for a bike ride wherever? Do you think there's an advantage to having that controlled sort of course? You know, in BMC's case, it's the velodrome. Is there a benefit to that?
Yeah, I think, again, actually, most bike brands that are really successful do have that backyard that is, you know, it might be like Villiers with the kind of Bassano del Grappa region, you know, all these climbs out the back of it, and you know all these bike brands in Milan that have the Stelvio within touching distance. I think, yeah, and I don't know many brands that make a success of it without having people based there that do a lot of riding of the product. I think it's worth saying, I think sometimes it is to the detriment of some products, because I think there's an old kind of understanding that a lot of Italian frames, and actually I'd say maybe Californian manufactured frames, are just a bit too harsh for British roads and for many roads across the world, because they're used to testing them on these beautifully paved Italian roads or these Californian roads. And, you know, like the Specialized original Venge, you know, was probably great in Morgan Hill. I've ridden on the roads there and it's smooth. And, you know, there's the Specialized Lunch Ride, which is another example of, you know, the backyard kind of testing process. But actually, the Specialized Lunch Ride, yeah, I should probably explain that, because that's worth talking about, which is that a lot of the guys go out every lunch and they race each other. Well, they're meant to go on a 40k loop, but it is just a flat out race the Specialized guys do.
Right.
And I did it once. I'm like, there's guys on rollers beforehand. It's not just a lunch ride. They're properly warming up. they're like fully fueled. They're ready to go. And it's like absolutely from the gun. They're out. And I think the Thursday is the most prestigious one. I think winning like a Thursday lunch ride at Specialized, you're like a made man. Like, you've got a salary for life there.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You become CEO the next day.
Yeah, that process, I think, is really good for like feeding in that passion and making products that cyclists just love. But at the same time, there is sometimes a bike design for like a certain terrain that doesn't fit with some consumers that are based in areas where roads are rougher or climbs are steeper or any of that kind of stuff. So I find that kind of personal first person testing really crucial. And it's the flip side of that is your brands that design too numerically and design around wind tunnel results and, you know, Tour magazine tests. And a lot of time, you know, you get given these bikes for review and like, this is the best bike in the world, apparently, but it just isn't that much fun to ride. And you're like, well, it's not a very good bike, in my opinion. And that's, I think, when that comes through that process that hasn't been honed by people that really love the sport, riding it day in, day out during the development.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, there are brands that are pretty ingenious with the ways they get around some of those things. Like, for example, and I keep going back to Trek because that was the last facility I was at, was in Wisconsin. But they actually built this machine in-house to replicate Roubaix cobbles. And so what they did was they actually went to Roubaix and they took a mold of the cobbles on the Arenberg. And they brought that mold back to Wisconsin and they created this track on a treadmill sort of thing. And it mirrored those cobbles. And they actually hang a rider from a harness and they can ride on the cobbles on this treadmill. So that's a pretty ingenious way to get around that. Is it the same thing? Not really. But does it get them the data they need? Yeah. But again, you know, some small builder in the middle of nowhere is not going to have the budget for something like that, but they could make a product that's just as good. So, you know, the manufacturing processes and the R&D, engineers just have to be very creative and really ingenious to come to the end of a product cycle and say, okay, we've created something that we think is going to work. Because you can do all the rides you want up, you know, the Stelvio in the prototyping phase. But like you said, how does it ride in the middle of New York State? You know, that's a variable.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think that, yeah, I often think about those standalone builders that do that, building it in their garage. You know, Bob Parlay was one, and the guy in the UK, Richard Craddock, he makes filament bikes, and that's like just done in his garage. And I think both of them had a similar process where they made an autoclave type thing out of like insulated foam. And I always find it like quite surreal to think of that first ride they take on it, to be like, you built this and you literally, it's just carbon fiber, it could completely fall apart. It must be so nerve-wracking. But but yeah, that process is interesting. I think you're right, there's more beyond, like, and I think Trek's a good example actually, because I've seen at the Trek facility, certainly when I visited it, they had quite a big part of their manufacturing testing there was on looking at how the technicians would lay up the bike given the instructions they were given in the layup schedule, and seeing whether they made mistakes. And that's a really interesting thing, I think, where you're like, the manufacturing isn't just about how brilliant the bike's designed or like how much the user might like it, but how reliably made can it be when you're making 15,000 of them, which I find like a super interesting part of bike design, because it's almost so dull that no one thinks about it. But you're like, yeah, you know, you could design the best bike in the world, but if this person in, you know, in Wisconsin or China or Taiwan just can't make it work when they're forcing this bit of carbon fiber thread into a panel of you know, of a mold, it's going to be a bad bike, because it's going to fail, or it's not going to be, you know, as stiff as it's meant to be. So yeah, it's interesting. And then that feedback process, you know, of whether they ride it themselves or their relationship with their customers and dealers and journalists, of course, it's yeah, it's a complex structure.
Yeah. And one thing I will note that I think is probably the most valuable aspect of both the BMC facility in Gretchen and also the Trek facility in Waterloo. And I've never been to Morgan Hill, which is strange. I've never been to Specialized. So I don't know if they have this as well, but at BMC and in Trek, they have a museum, essentially, of their old bikes that pros have, you know, ridden and had success on.
They have that Morgan Hill.
And you look
as well
at some of the, yeah, of course. I mean, I would be shocked if they didn't. Yeah, and I think that's probably the most valuable tool in both of these facilities, is to be able to go back and see what worked, what didn't, how did we change, what was the evolution like, and what have we learned since then. To have that frame of reference has got to be invaluable, especially with bigger companies where engineers come and go. You know, it's not like, you know, some of these places, these engineers have probably been around for decades, but some maybe this is their first job. And so they need to have that historical perspective. So to be able to walk through and handle these bikes and feel them and see them and note, you know, different evolutions of frame design. I mean, that must be so invaluable for these companies. So perhaps that's an advantage over smaller builders that these bigger companies do have, and specifically brands like BMC that has been around a long time and has had so much success at the World Tour level.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting that you say that, actually, because it does remind me of the fact that I think a lot of modern bike designers do forget the historic design efforts that are made. Like, not that many people know that much about the history of bike design, and you do see things come around and people laud them as being like the first of their kind, and you're like, no, that they did that like 35 years ago and it was rubbish. And you think, right, like, you know, yeah. I mean, like, you know, a road bike suspension, you know, I don't think is rubbish now, but it is definitely something that people do get really excited about and act as if it's a brand new invention. You're like, no, this real, right, the same exact thing. You know, like Moot's YBB, you know, that when Pinarello had their, I forget what they called the unit, the DSS-1, I think, it was the exact same thing as the YBB. And it was like, this, Moot's did this like 15 years ago for road bikes, and, you know, buy that unit and see how that works. You know, it's just funny. And,
Yeah,
definitely. Similarly, actually, I remember Rota, when they launched their hydraulic group set, they were like, this is the first hydraulic group set ever. And I was like, no, it is not. I was like, Shimano did the in-flight years and years ago, and they, you know, that was for downhill. Right. But it's just funny. I think people just don't realize the legacy that comes behind a lot of time in development. And yeah, within a brand, I guess that's so important when you're like, well, how does the lineage of the original tarmac play into the modern tarmac? And yeah, I think it's super important. And I think it's why, again, those old brands, there's a lot of value to them, because they do have that legacy of having successful product year in, year out, and that feedback from users and consumers and retailers and everyone.
And I think it's important to note that in those museums of bikes, not every one of those bikes was a success, you know, and not all the feedback they got was good. And that's just as valuable, you know, learning from that. So you have this reference, basically this encyclopedia of bikes where you can say, okay, that worked, this didn't, let's go with this, or maybe this would work now that we have this other thing that developed after that, you know? So there's just a lot of perspective to be gleaned there, I think.
Yeah, I think the Impact's a good example actually of that, because I think it was a really successful bike in its time and a really nice bike, but I think it was probably ahead of its time, and it had this kind of super rigid and very well engineered concept behind it. But maybe it was a time when people ran 23mm tires, so it might have been a super rough ride. I mean, I never actually got to ride one, so I don't know. But you know, they were very popular. They sold out all the time, so it's not, we don't want to criticize them, but definitely it's something that you think, yeah, could be more successful if it was brought out today.
Absolutely. I mean, think about like the Mavic electronic group sets way back in the day, you know, ahead of their time, you know. We now, almost all of us, ride electronic group sets or wireless group sets, and they did it way back when, and it just never caught on. And there was just things at that point that they didn't know. And over time, it was improved, and now it works. But, you know, they were just well ahead of their time and couldn't pull it off. So that's a good frame of reference for how development works over time anyway.
Can I ask actually, Dan, have you ever been to like a Far Eastern manufacturing facility?
I haven't.
Yeah. No, I've not either.
I was supposed to go to Taiwan just before COVID hit.
Oh, on the giant trip. I was going to do that as well, I think. Yeah. I was meant to go there.
Yeah, because they were opening a brand new facility, and that would have been my first facility that I would have visited there, and I was really excited to look at it. I got invited once to a tire facility in Thailand, and I didn't get to go to that one either. But I think for perspective, I would love to do something like that for sure.
Yeah, because that's that mass manufacturing we just don't see. Because even like Trek, right, with Wisconsin, it's a huge facility, but they only make like a couple of hundred bikes a year there, and it's massive. Yep. But then you get the idea that these vast warehouses you actually need for making thousands of bikes, a different scale entirely.
Yep. Yeah, that would be a good perspective trip for us, I think. Maybe we should set something like that up. Peter, this has been pretty fascinating stuff, and you know, I'd like to thank BMC obviously for sharing some of their processes with us, and that's always fascinating to learn. If you all have questions, you can always reach out to us. I am reachable on the social media via @BrownTieDan. Peter, where can they reach you and Rulure?
You can reach me on Instagram or Twitter @PeterStewart3, Stuart, and you can reach Rulure through every social media channel, except for TikTok, we're not on that yet, but we're always Rulure or Rulure Magazine, one word. So yeah, reach out to us, comment, share, like, message. We'll try do our best to respond.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you what you thought about this episode, and obviously if you have you know, topics you'd like us to cover on this podcast, we would absolutely love to hear it. I for one am always a fan of when people do my work for me, so please tell me what you would like to hear us babble on about. Peter, thanks for joining me to chat about this. It's fun as always.
You too, much appreciated.
All right, we'll talk soon. Thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.